This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So I've been tasked with discussing what devices work, where, and for how long. And this is obviously a somewhat difficult challenge when you consider the diverse type of data we have to support what we do in the SFA and popliteal circulation. But I do think if you sift through some of the data, you'll find there are some right and wrong answers to how to approach the FEMPOP circulation. And I'm going to try to give somewhat of a 30,000-foot overview of what are some of the absolutes that we do know about these different devices and maybe some of the limitations as well. These are on my disclosures, some of which are relevant to this discussion as well. So I think one thing that's definitely clear is we've had an explosion of devices in the last 10 years. In addition to that, we also have new techniques now that we're using routinely that really are helping us accomplish things from an endovascular standpoint that we couldn't do before. So this is a typical patient that we treated. My fellow Dr. Rollo and I treated this patient about 3 weeks ago. It's an 87-year-old woman with end-stage renal disease, aortic stenosis, all of the things that make us not want to do an open operation on her. What you're seeing here in these images is a persistent sciatic artery that occludes at the mid-thigh. The entire popliteal is occluded, and then she reconstitutes the AT near the origin there. So we couldn't cross-antegrade. This is a case where we had to use retrograde access by puncturing the DP and coming up from below. This allowed us to establish through-and-through wire access from the groin all the way down into the anterior tibial artery. This was treated with balloon angioplasty and stenting with Supera because of the heavily calcified nature of this patient's disease. And you can see on the right the completion images, which shows inline flow all the way down to the AT and peroneal, which is actually a pretty good vessel as well, and flow all the way down to the foot to help her heal her wounds and gave her a palpable pulse on at least the proximal aspect of the foot. So I think we all recognize the potential advantages of percutaneous intervention, minimal sedation, minimal recovery time, et cetera. But of course, we've been plagued in the endovascular space with durability, and this is an issue that comes up very commonly. It's a big issue for our CLI patients, but I think it's even more of an issue for our claudicants, and therein lies a lot of debate about the appropriateness of some of these interventions for these patients. There's a high bar to which we have to measure the success of endovascular interventions, as obviously we have many decades of experience of open surgical bypass, and most series will demonstrate a roughly 80% or upwards of 80% primary patency at 1 to 2 years for these open surgical operations, at least with saphenous vein. And so when we're thinking about this high bar and we think about newer technologies, we have to ask ourselves whether some of these new devices that we have are closing this patency gap between open surgery and historic results with endovascular intervention. And also, what is the data to support these trials? Do we have the holy grail of randomized controlled trials? Or do we at least have some core lab adjudicated prospective registries that accurately describe lesion characteristics and outcomes, meaningful outcomes to at least judge our device by? Some of these type of trials, I think, do allow us to make some guideline recommendations or some firm recommendations rather than just support our own biases by smaller retrospective series. So these are some of the treatment options I'm going to discuss today. It's not a comprehensive list, but I do think it basically goes over the sort of historic approach we've had to endovascular intervention and what are some of the new technologies that are helping us really make a difference in terms of our patency rates and reducing our reintervention rates. I'm going to go over these sort of in pairs and then in some cases one by one. The first question I want to look at is balloon angioplasty versus nitinol stents. This is somewhat of an old question, and I think this has been fairly well settled. The initial angioplasty efforts were back in the 1960s. Obviously, angioplasty balloons and balloons designed specifically for the peripheral circulation have evolved. But we've, of course, had to deal with elastic recoil dissections and the biologic phenomenon of restenosis. Some of the ways we've handled these issues, at least the first two of those problems, have been using laser-cut nitinol stents that are cut out of nitinol tubes and therefore want to keep a rigid sort of structure when they're placed in the body and elsewhere. One of the earlier papers to really look at this question is this paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and this basically showed that primary stent implantation versus selective bailout stenting was associated with a lower rate of restenosis and an improved walking distance at 12 months in patients treated with primary stenting rather than selective stenting. So it basically just shows that stents do better than angioplasty when you look at all comers. This has been repeated, I would say, a number of times when companies or industry colleagues have gone to get FDA approval for SFA stents. durability stroll. These are some of the trials listed here. We've seen a common theme that the primary patency with balloon angioplasty alone is in the 30 to 50% range, where the primary patency in patients treated with stents is upwards of 60 to 80% in many of these trials. So I think there is good randomized controlled trial data to suggest that primary stent implantation is associated with improved primary patency at 1 to 2 years. Many studies have shown improved TLR rates and improved walking distance in this time frame. The problem or the caveats I would say is that putting stents in the SFA or any implant in the SFA or popliteal does have implications for future interventions and potentially surgical options, and there's little randomized controlled data beyond 2 to 3 years for these interventions. One of the issues with lower extremity interventions is a biologic restenosis problem, and so even though we can deal with some of the mechanical issues of dissections, et cetera, or recoil, the question is can we do anything to improve the restenosis rate from a biologic perspective? And that's where drug-coated stents come in, or paclitaxel in general. The Zilver PTX trial was the first trial to look at this, or actually the first trial to lead to an FDA approval of a drug-coated stent or a drug-eluting device in the SFA. For those of you who aren't familiar with the trial, which I'm sure most of you are, there was the initial enrollment included a randomization between PTA and stenting with the Zilver PTX, a paclitaxel-coated stainless nitinol stent. For those patients who had a suboptimal result with initial PTA, there was a secondary randomization between stenting with a bare metal stent and the Zilver PTX stent. And these patients were then followed out to 5 years, and this data has been recently presented. The lesion characteristics and patient characteristics in this study were very similar to those that we typically see in the other IDE trials. Fairly short lesions. A minority of these patients had very heavily calcified disease or chronic occlusions. But I do think the results were fairly impressive. And if you look at the one-year results, we found a primary patency in the 80% range, 83%, for those patients treated with Zilver PTX, which is significantly higher than those treated with either angioplasty or stenting with a bare metal stent. And the other important thing about this is you can see over the five-year course that the study was done, this was a sustained patency rate or patency advantage over the drug-coated technology compared to bare metal alone. So this is, I think, a good trial to show that paclitaxel does work. It does help prevent restenosis in the circulation. And this is good five-year data to suggest that if we're going to be using a nitinol stent, perhaps we should use one that can address this biologic phenomenon. Of course, the caveats are that we still have a permanent implant and its implications. And this is only a comparison between Zilver PTX and the bare metal Zilver or angioplasty, which you may or may not be using routinely anyway. But I would say that the 80% one-year primary patency, you know, begs the question of whether or not this is a modality that is could be as good as some of our bypass operations. And there is an interesting study looking at this that is ongoing between prosthetic bypass and Zilver PTX called the Zilver Pass trial. And this takes in mind there's been an evolution of technology since the initial basal trial that looked at endovascular versus open surgery. Takes in mind that there's differences in assessment between our IDE trials for SFA devices and some of the bypass series that we discussed, where even a palpable pulse could be taken as a patent graft. And so the Zilver Pass trial is a multi-center European trial that is randomizing patients on a one-to-one basis between prosthetic bypass and Zilver PTX. And this is just some preliminary. These are some of the preliminary results presented by Condaluce at LINC 2017, and it basically shows that of the first 199 patients, I believe, had been enrolled at this point, and 115 of these were available for an interim analysis, and it showed that there was no difference in primary patency or in freedom from TLR in this group of patients. And so this would suggest, although this is still in progress and this is only looking at prosthetic bypass, not saphenous bypass, it would suggest that some of our bypass patients in the fem-pop circulation could be well served by some of our newer modalities as well. So percutaneous atherectomy, I want to move into this. This is a bad word in some surgical circles, certainly, and I think there's good reason for this. The data for percutaneous atherectomy is very scant, considering the wide adoption, the high reimbursement, and the high cost of these devices. I do think this is a useful tool, but I also would say these are actually multiple tools. And one of the things to keep in mind about atherectomy is that there's not one type of atherectomy. There's at least four different types of atherectomy and different devices within these categories. And this also sort of blurs the data when we try to evaluate these devices. There is growing data. There's a growing body of literature for these devices, but the problem that I'll highlight in a couple of slides is that this data is quite variable in terms of its outcomes. There's practically no randomized trial data or comparator data between two modalities we use, atherectomy versus another modality. And so this is the problem when we're looking through and sorting through that data. Probably the best piece of data to justify the use of atherectomy in the FemPop circulation comes from the definitive LE trial. And this is not a randomized trial, but a prospective industry-sponsored registry of about 800 patients, including both CLI and claudicants. Now, the good part about this trial is it does have core lab adjudication describing the lesion characteristics and objectively adjudicating the outcomes of this and reporting significant or clinically relevant outcomes, primary patency, and in some cases, freedom from TLR. But the other thing that it points out... So the one other thing I want to point out to you is a bailout stent rate. This is another common thing we'll see throughout these atherectomy trials, even those that don't report really clinically relevant outcomes, a very low bailout stent rate. So these studies would suggest at least that we can achieve revascularization of the SFA with a very low stent rate compared to balloon angioplasty with selective stenting. Another common thing that you'll see in all of these trials, unfortunately, is an embolization rate that is higher than what we would typically expect from balloon angioplasty and stenting. In the definitive LE trial, they showed, a 3% bailout stent rate, lower than the 20 to 30% we typically see in other angioplasty with selective stenting trials. And if you look at the overall cohort, the primary patency in this study of 800 patients is about 78, 77%, no difference between diabetics and non-diabetics. And when you look at the CLI cohort, about the one-third of patients that had critical ischemia, you find a primary patency which is slightly lower, but on par with the overall cohort, and a limb salvage rate which is similar to many of our retrospective series of surgical bypass. So I think that this is useful data, although it's certainly not the holy grail of clinical trial data and leaves a lot to be desired. I think that's even more true when you look at some of the other atherectomy modalities. When you look at orbital atherectomy, the problems with the studies looking at this is that these trials, if they're randomized, are extremely small. No core lab adjudication of the endpoints, even though some of them report decent primary patencies. On the other hand, when you look at some of the larger registries, there's a complete absence of any clinically relevant endpoint data or assessment of lesions or those sort of things, yet we still keep seeing these high rates of embolization and other complications. One of the other areas where we have some reasonable quality data to support atherectomy is in the use of laser atherectomy for in-stent restenosis. So the EXCITE ISR trial, sponsored by Spectranetics, is a trial that got an on-label indication for the use of laser atherectomy in in-stent restenosis and in-stent occlusions. And this trial was actually halted early. The goal was a 250-patient enrollment. It was halted early because of a significantly a higher rate of adverse events in the patients treated with angioplasty alone rather than laser atherectomy for in-stent restenosis. And that would basically came in the form of repeat TLRs. And so it suggests that the even though the primary patency wasn't reported in the initial publication, they had a lower rate of repeat target lesion revascularization in the laser arm. And so this is at least some randomized controlled trial data to suggest that there may be a role for laser atherectomy in these difficult in-stent restenosis trials patients. So I think that for percutaneous atherectomy, we still have a lot to be desired in terms of meaningful clinical data. There is randomized controlled trial evidence for in-stent restenosis treatment with laser atherectomy. There's at least one large prospective core lab adjudicated study that describes the lesion characteristics in the patients fairly well and describes the type of outcomes we may be able to achieve in those patients. The one thing that's been shown universally, of course, is this low rate of bailout stenting. So I think if nothing else, this is a tool in which we can reduce our stent rate in longer lesions or complex lesions in the SFA. Another route of avoiding long-term permanent implants is the use of drug-coated balloon angioplasty. Obviously, this has been an important topic in recent years, as we have now two devices on the market that allow us to treat these patients with some sort of drug-eluting technology without leaving a permanent implant behind. So the Levant 2 trial and the IMPACT SFA trial were the two IDE trials that got approval for these two balloons that we now have for drug-coated balloon angioplasty. And they both had a very similar design, and I'll point out to you the screening process. There's an initial screening process. Is a patient potentially a candidate for the study in general, and his lesion reasonable for a drug-coated balloon or angioplasty alone. The patient then had to undergo a successful pre-dilatation with balloon angioplasty and have an angiographically acceptable result, at which point they were then randomized in the trial either to receive a repeat balloon angioplasty with a plain balloon or a drug-coated balloon. So you can imagine this leads to a significant selection bias in terms of fairly short and non-calcified and fairly non-complex lesions, very few total occlusions in this group, very little calcification. That said, both of these devices and both of these trials were positive trials. They did show a benefit to the drug-eluting or drug-coated technology. In the Levant trial, there was about a 16 or 17% percentage point difference in primary patency between plain balloon angioplasty and the drug-coated balloon. In the IMPACT SFA trial, we had about a 25 to 30% 365-day and then 390-day difference in primary patency between balloon angioplasty and drug-coated balloon angioplasty. So I think both of these studies does show that there's a superiority of primary patency and TLR rates in using this drug eluting technology. One of the problems to this, though, is kind of what I alluded to before. These were fairly selected patients with simple lesions, and all of the studies, both here and worldwide, that have looked at drug-coated balloon angioplasty, have shown that as we get increasingly complex lesions, longer lesions, we have a problem with need for increased stent usage. So these balloons alone obviously don't deal with the mechanical issues involved. So there are some cases where we certainly are going to need to use stents. This is probably borne out pretty well in the IMPACT Global registry. So this is a more real-world, non-randomized registry after the IMPACT SFA trial. And this basically is a large study that mostly does not include core lab adjudicated endpoints, but there are three imaging cohorts which did actually look at every patient and ran them through a core lab. And included in those are the long lesion cohort, the CTO cohort, and the ISR cohort. And the two I want to bring your attention to are the long lesion and the CTO cohorts, which have very long lesions of greater than 20 centimeters. So these are lesions we actually do see on a regular basis and treat. And they were able to achieve a very high primary patency of greater than 80% in these two cohorts. But that did, of course, come with a very high rate of bailout stenting, almost 50% adjunctive stent rate in order to get these kind of results. So DCBs may maintain high patency rates and low TLR rates in more complex lesions, but it does come at a cost of requiring a bailout stent in a good percentage of the cases. So to summarize on angioplasty versus DCBs, I think that there are three randomized controlled trials. Of course, there's another one that will be coming out soon, hopefully leading to approval of another device, but we have two devices available. And these devices have certainly shown that there is effect of the drug, just as with the paclitaxel-coated stents. They do show improved patency rates at 1 year and likely improved TLR rates. And at least with the IMPACT study, if you look at those subsequent publications or presentations, it does seem like this effect is maintained out to 2 and 3 years and could be applied in complex lesions, as I've shown, with the caveat that these are where we're going to need some bailout stenting as well. So if we accept that stenting is going to continue being a part of what we do as interventionalists for the FEMPOP circulation, then the next question is, can we improve upon the laser cut nitinol stents that we have used up to this point? And I think the answer is maybe. The most recent device to hit the market in terms of next generation stents is the Gore Tigra stent. And this is an interesting stent because it's actually just a nitinol wire over which is coated a PTFE, heparin bonded PTFE coating. And so the one of the amazing characteristics of the stent is it's incredibly flexible, and you can imagine where it would be very helpful in the popliteal or even the distal SFA or places where we have a lot of kinking and torsion and those kind of forces. This stent was studied in the Tigris trial, which is basically a randomization, 3-to-1 randomization to Tigris or the Bard Life stent in almost 300 patients. And one of the things to point out in this trial is that the flexibility of the stent, I think, did certainly improve its stent fracture resistance. And so stent fractures have unanimously or ubiquitously been associated with loss of patency in all of the IDE trials. And this particular study showed that in all the patients randomized to Tigris, they had 0% stent fractures, which is impressive and was one of the few times we've seen this in a clinical trial. Now, the real problem here, though, is that the reduction in stent fracture rate or the obliteration of the stent fractures did not, unfortunately, translate into improved primary patency rate. So I think that the failure to achieve improved primary patency despite the absence of stent fractures begs the question of where and when we're going to maybe decide to use this device or how helpful this device could be. This has not been published yet. This has only been presented, so maybe there will be additional details on where this could be useful in other in certain settings. So the other next generation stent I would bring your attention to is the Abbott Supera stent, and this is basically six nitinol wires connected only at the ends, and that again gives it a property of very improved flexibility compared to most other stents, and it gives it a tremendous amount of crush resistance compared to other stents, as shown in this graph here. This was evaluated in the SUPERB trial, which is the IDE-sponsored prospective registry that got IDE approval for this device in the SFA. This is a trial that included core lab adjudication, had a mean lesion length of 78 millimeters, and I would draw your attention to about 73% moderate to severe calcification. So these were tough lesions, calcified lesions. The majority of these implants were in the popliteal or distal SFA, and this also showed an absence of stent fractures across the entire trial, which has also been seen in many of the other prospective evaluations of this device and retrospective registries as well. Let me go back one, I'm sorry. So those of us who use this device regularly have seen the fact that it can handle these type of very calcified areas like this over here and still maintain a nice round appearance that you can see very well either on IVUS or duplex, and can handle the flexibility that we see at the popliteal and other locations. The patency rate of this device is dependent on its deployment. And so one of the problems with this device is that deployment can be fairly tough, and the length of the device once it's deployed can be variable depending on how well you prep the lesion and how well the device expands. If it remains compressed when you're deploying it, it will be elongated, and then you're going to lose your primary patency advantage that this stent seems to have over other devices. So if we look at the stents that are deployed to nominal deployment, meaning to their intended length in the SUPERB trial, we found almost 91% primary patency at 1 year. And this is pretty much unheard of in IDE trials that look at an SFA device, even when you look at those with like Zilver PTX that have a drug associated with them. So with nominal deployment, we have a very good primary patency rate with this device and a sustained TLR out to 3 years. Unfortunately, we don't have primary patency data out to 3 years. Now, if you look at where this falls among the list of other devices, you see it's at the upper end in terms of the overall primary patency of the trial of 86%, primary patency at 1 year, and then again with nominal deployment, we can maybe even achieve a little better. So I think that the evidence for the next generation stents includes randomized controlled trial data, prospective registry data. The main thing I think that we found in these devices is absence of stent fractures, and I think that the other issues such as primary patency and freedom from TLR are probably device dependent. And the caveats with the SUPERB trials is there's no comparator arm, and there's no comparator between this and other modalities we use on a regular basis. So I'd finish here and conclude by saying that evidence to judge the effectiveness of both old and emerging technology is incomplete, but it is improving. Plain balloon angioplasty and bare metal laser cut nitinol stents are probably below the standard of care at this point, considering the wealth of treatment options we have today. Atherectomy is an effective tool for reducing bailout stent rates in FEMPOP interventions. I think this is probably the strongest statement we can make about atherectomy at this point until more data is accrued. And I would argue the paclitaxel coating on either balloons or stents certainly has a role. It does seem to have a biologic effect and probably ought to be used liberally in our interventions. Finally, as lesion complexity increases, the need for stenting also increases and probably should be done with some of our next generation devices, either that we have now or hopefully we'll have soon. Thank you.
Question?
Thank you very much. That was a great talk. I know this is probably a tough question and maybe not much data to support it, but you talked about atherectomy and you talked about drug-coated balloons separate, but you didn't mention anything about doing both of them, which is happening a lot, I think. I'm wondering if you know about any data on that, which there may not be.
Yeah, so that's a very good question. I think that's been a very big topic in the past few years at different meetings. I think it intuitively to me it makes sense as the perfect combination, because atherectomy can deal with some of the mechanical issues of calcification, dissections, things like that. But those of you who use atherectomy know that especially in soft lesions, it seems we see a vicious rate of restenosis in some patients, and they come back and back and back. So combining that with an anti-restenotic drug is certainly a nice option. There have been a few small trials. There's one trial called the Definitive AR trial. Which was a combination of atherectomy plus DCB compared to DCB alone. This was an industry-sponsored trial as well, 100 patients, so it was kind of more of a pilot study. And it was essentially a negative trial. It did not show a benefit to the combination therapy, but it did show some signals, some areas where we think this combination could be more effective or most effective. And those were specifically patients that were debulked to less than 30% residual stenosis before using the DCB, and those patients who had longer and more calcified lesions. And so that initial pilot data has prompted the reality trial, which I'm actually part of, and it's basically a prospective registry in which we're looking at these very complicated lesions, long lesions up actually there's no upper limit in Europe for the trial in terms of the lengths of the lesions, looking only at lesions which are heavily calcified and using the combination of DCB and atherectomy with core lab adjudication for both the angio core lab and IVUS core lab, so we can really define these lesions and determine the likelihood of a successful long-term primary patency result with this combination therapy. Now, unfortunately, this doesn't have a comparator arm. We couldn't get the funding for a randomized trial to really look at this the way we all would want to do it. But I do think that's one of the more important studies that's going to look at this combination therapy coming down the pipeline.
Thank you. One other question, if you don't mind. I think a lot of the talk seemed to be centered around fem-pop disease, which is reasonable. But tibial disease is probably the greater threat for patients in my practice. And I've been practicing about 13 years. I got to be honest, I didn't do too many fem dorsalis pedis bypasses when I was in training. And I'm wagering not many graduates are doing that many of them now, although I could be wrong with Dr. Conti. Maybe they are, but some places maybe not. Bottom line question, tibial disease. I don't think we put stents in there. What do you do there? Atherectomy? Do you do balloon only? What works well there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you hit the nail on the head with the challenges we have for peripheral interventions. I think we have a lot of great options for the fem-pop space, and there are some things that are making a difference, I think, in terms of primary patency. We don't have the same for the tibial space. And if you think about it, the only thing we have that's approved or on label is angioplasty or atherectomy. So when the companies are designing or considering clinical trials to look at this space, they don't even know what to compare it to. I would say that the best evidence supported advice for the tibial circulation are drug eluting stents. There's been several randomized controlled trials, European trials, that have looked at drug eluting stents versus angioplasty, drug eluting stents versus drug coated balloons. And the common finding in all of these is that drug eluting stents perform better in the tibial circulation than anything else that we do, at least based on these trials. The problem with that is that as surgeons, we don't love the idea of putting permanent implants in general, or at least I don't, and I certainly feel even more so about that statement in the tibial circulation. So I think that the tibials are still where we have, we do a lot of interventions now in the tibial circulation. We do see a high rate of restenosis. We need some better devices. A couple of companies are revamping their below knee. There's obviously a below knee trial ongoing for drug coated balloons that will hopefully pan out. The other companies that have failed in this space are reengaging that area. So hopefully in the next few years we'll have some more data to answer that question without the need for a permanent implant.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.